I remember the time I tried to introduce my daughter Lily, then 2 years old, to one of my favorite children's books. There is a monster at the end of this book, starring lovable, furry old Grover. To begin with, Lily was excited about Grover and allowed me to read her the book. About halfway through the book, though, she grabbed it out of my hands and slammed it shut. "That's a scary monster," she told me. "I don't want it."
That's the Reverend Dr. Nate Phillips, and today he brings you a powerful message of faith and hope. I'm Peter Wallace. This is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Dr. Nate Phillips, co-pastor of Red Clay Creek Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, Delaware. Nate is a graduate of the University of Maine in his home state. He earned his Master of Divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary and his Doctor of Ministry degree from Columbia Theological Seminary, where he received the John Nelson Award for the best thesis project focusing on aiding the transformation of a congregation into a missional church. He is the author of the new book, Do Something Else, The Road Ahead for the Mainline Church. Nate, welcome to Day One.
Thanks for having me, Peter. It's good to be here.
You grew up in the hills of central Maine, the son of a logger and a wedding dress seamstress, and you were shaped spiritually by a very interesting cooperative parish in rural Maine. Tell us how that unfolded for you.
So Mission at the Eastward is a 9-church cooperative parish, all small churches in the hills of western Maine. I grew up there as a member of a small church called West Mills Community Church. And I think the most formative aspect of the mission for me was their summer camp. On their own, none of these churches could have done anything like have a summer camp or housing ministries like they have, or safe visitor programs or cooperatives with international churches. But together, they were able to administer this summer camp. And through that experience, I was shaped and found church.
And that led to a calling.
Yeah, that led to a calling. I remember graduating from college and having a friend say, "What are you going to do with yourself now?" And I had a psychology degree, which meant there wasn't a whole lot I could do. I needed to go get my master's. And he said, "Well, what do you love to do?" And I said, "Well, I love to counsel camp." And so that's what I decided to do. I decided to spend my life counseling camp. And to be honest, I still look at pastoring, to some extent, like being a camp counselor.
So after you graduated from Princeton Seminary, you were ordained to serve Red Clay Creek Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, Delaware, as co-pastor in 2006. How does the co-pastorate work?
Well, my colleague and I, Patrick, we are two peas in a pod, but very different kinds of peas, I guess is the way I put it. We do very different things, and we have a different tone in the way we approach ministry. And since we do, we tend to complement one another in the ways that we interact with people and go about the mission of the church.
How would you describe your congregation and its mission and ministry?
Red Clay is a good-sized suburban church, like many good-sized suburban churches, has a pretty broad tent approach to most theological and social issues. And I really enjoy serving that kind of church. I've put it before that I like ideological diversity, but not ideological complacency. Hmm. So I think we have good conversations. And I think they're open. It's a 295-year-old church. Hmm. And I can't ever suggest something without having someone say, "We've tried that before," right? And many pastors can say that, but I'm very thankful for this church because almost always that has been followed by, "But it doesn't mean we can't try it again." So it's a great church.
You have written a fascinating book full of innovative ideas for the future of the church, including numerous case studies of fresh expressions of church that are happening right now. The book is called Do Something Else, The Road Ahead for the Mainline Church, from Whipf and Stock, Cascade Books. First, set some context for us. Where is the church today, and why do you think it's struggling?
I think of church like I think of coffee hour. You know, when we have coffee hour after a worship service, we expect everyone to go from the sanctuary to wherever it is that we have the coffee set up. And we hope that everyone will just go there. But that's not how it is, at least at my church. We have people that leave through different exits, and they go and they visit with people in different meeting rooms, or they're going to go pick up their kids in Sunday school. They don't all go the same way. And what I'm realizing that we need to do with our coffee hour is set up stations and invite people to congregate around their coffee in places that maybe we're not accustomed to having them congregate. Instead of insisting that they go where we want them to go, why not set up stations where they can run into the church, in fact, trip over the coffee hour? And so you can see where I'm going with this metaphor, and I think this is where the church needs to be thoughtful, and that's what the book is trying to offer. How do we set up new stations for folks to be tripping over the church, wherever it is that they're heading, instead of insisting that they go in the direction to the sanctuary that we have always just assumed they would go?
So you offer a number of ways forward. How do you hope readers will respond to your book?
Well, I hope they talk about it. I've gotten really good feedback about the book, and I can tell you that one of the words most often used with the book by church folks is, well, interesting. And so I think people are open to new things. I think that we have to start the conversation somewhere. And I thought the best way to do that was to say, hey, look, folks are already doing some of this stuff. Talk about it. Is this for you? Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But we shouldn't just disregard new ideas as if they can't be done, because, in fact, they are being done.
You're also active in innovative ministry in your presbytery and recently established the FIRST initiative there. Tell us about that.
The FIRST initiative, freeing the imagination of the recently seminary trained. We shoehorned that title in there pretty good. And what the idea behind that is to use the presbytery's influence and finances, quite frankly, to invite pastors to come into our presbytery as evangelists and to set up new worshiping communities. Lots of our churches either don't have the financial means or the vision to start new worshiping communities, but as a presbytery, we can be inspirational in that way, and it's been a really great experience. I can't say that it's gone so smoothly. We've just had, you know, new churches popping up everywhere, but we've learned a lot. And I'm really, really satisfied with the friendships that we've made through this program. And also, you know, the way the gospel's been shared to and with folks that maybe wouldn't have heard it otherwise.
Well, Nate, your sermon today focuses on the gospel text for this Sunday from Luke chapter 16. Would you read the passage for us?
Sure. The text today is Luke 16, 19 through 31. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus, in like manner, evil things? But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us." He said, "Then, Father, I beg you to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them." He said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." And he said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead."
Quite a contrast here between the rich man and Lazarus in this parable of Jesus. We look forward to hearing more about this, Nate, in your sermon entitled "A Monster at the End of This Sermon." Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Peter. I remember the time I tried to introduce my daughter Lily, then 2 years old, to one of my favorite children's books. There is a monster at the end of this book, starring lovable, furry old Grover. To begin with, Lily was excited about Grover, even if she thought he was Elmo, and allowed me to read her the book. About halfway through the book, though, she grabbed it out of my hands and slammed it shut. "That's a scary monster," she told me. "I don't want it." As disappointed as I was, I said, "Okay, we don't have to read it." And I put the book back on the shelf. The next day, I found the scary monster book in the refrigerator freezer at Lily level. Lily was just a child, and she could still get away with putting the scary story in the freezer. In fact, it was kind of cute, and it won't be long before she, like the rest of us, has to look far too many scary stories right in the eyes. The titles range from "Goodbye, My Love" to "Why Me?" The characters are named illness, tragedy, poverty, and hopelessness. I thank God every day that Lily doesn't have to meet these characters just yet. Grover was too much for her. My guess is that you don't have to look too far to read your scary story. My guess is that your scary story can't be hidden in the freezer. But if you can't think of one, perhaps you might take in your hands the scary story of today's text. Once there was a man named Lazarus. Your scary story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus. Lazarus lived outside of a gate. This is scary enough, but Lazarus didn't just live outside the gate. He lay outside the gate. Actually, the text says, literally, he was thrown outside the gate. The Greek verb used here is built from the verb meaning to throw. This is important to note because while it is a common verb, it is only used a handful of times in the New Testament in reference to a human being. Inside the gate, a rich man wore purple cloth to cover his skin. Outside the gate, Lazarus' skin was covered with sores. Inside the gate, a rich man rejoiced with great vigor every day. Outside the gate, Lazarus hungered for even the droppings from the table of the rich man. Inside the gate, the dogs laid claim to those droppings, and for dessert, they went outside the gate to feast on the sores of Lazarus. Eventually, Lazarus died, and an angel carried him to heaven. Your story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus, but if your characters have been thrown aside like a piece of trash, if they've been disregarded as something less than human, then yes, your scary story might have something in common with that of Lazarus. Once there was a man named Lazarus, your scary story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus, but the paralytics did. The Gospel of Matthew tells us that the paralytic lived on a bed. Actually, I should rephrase, the paralytic lay on a bed, or more literally, like with Lazarus, the paralytic was thrown down on the bed.
We don't know much about the paralytic, but we do know that he was desperately ill. So desperate, in fact, that he insisted that his friends take him to see Jesus. And when they couldn't slip him through the crowd, they hoisted him up on a roof and lowered him in. Your scary story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus, but if the characters in your story have been thrown down like the paralytic, thrown down with an illness, if they've been thrown down with something that they can't shake, something that won't let them back up, then yes, your scary story might have something in common with that of Lazarus. Once there was a man named Lazarus. Your scary story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus, but a certain slave's did. The Gospel of Matthew tells us that the certain slave lived in a jail. Actually, I should rephrase. He was put in jail. Or more literally, like with Lazarus, he was thrown in jail. As Matthew tells it, there was a king who forgave the debt of one slave only to have that very same slave imprison our certain slave for failing to pay him back. It didn't take long for our certain slave's fellow slaves to carry word of this injustice and convince the king to set things right. Your story might not have anything in common with that of Lazarus. But if the characters in your story have ever been thrown away, like our certain slave, left behind for something they didn't do, cast aside for something outside of their control, then yes, your scary story might have something in common with that of Lazarus. Once there was a man named Lazarus. Once there was a paralytic. Once there was a certain slave. The characters in your story might not have anything in common with these, but they have at least two things in common with one another. First, they were all thrown. They were thrown aside, thrown down, and thrown away. Second, they were all carried. The certain slave was carried by his fellow slaves. The paralytic was carried by his friends. And Lazarus was carried by an angel. Which leaves us to wonder, why did Lazarus have to wait for an angel? Which leaves us to wonder how much scarier was his scary story on this side of heaven without friends. And as we wonder, a question emerges. Amidst the scary stories, do we live out the story of the rich man, or do we carry the story of the church? If we live out the story of the rich man, well, Lazarus bleeds alone, but if we live out the story of the church, Lazarus will never have to wait. Never have to wait all the way until the angels bring him comfort. Never have to face the story without a friend. A special kind of friend. The kind of friend that knows what my childhood friend Larry Kane knows. Larry Kane was famous in my hometown for his God-given ability to catch good-sized trout from a mud puddle and bag a healthy buck on the first day of hunting season. I can remember as a teenager going brook fishing with Larry Kane. He loved to take me along because in Maine you can catch a limit of only 5 brook trout per day, and I usually didn't catch any, which meant he could catch 10. I didn't mind. He would usually hook one for me and let me reel it in. I can remember one sunny day while fishing with Larry, I got my line caught so badly in a tree stump that I lost my hook and bait. I threw down my rod, sat down on the bank, and watched the water go by. He came over to help me get set up again, I pulled my face out of my hands and looked down at his hip, where he had a bounty of 4 beautiful trout hanging on a stick through his belt loop. I finally asked him, "Why can't I catch any fish? I don't think the fish like my bait." He laughed and looked down at the water. "It's not the bait. It's not the fish. It's where you're standing. Look, you're casting your shadow right into the fishing hole, and it's scaring them. The fish are there, and they are hungry. But it matters where you stand." I didn't know it then, but while Larry was giving me a fishing tip, he could have just as easily been introducing the teenage me to a new, broadened definition of friendship. The kind of friendship that the church needs to learn. In friendship, just as in fishing, it matters where we stand. This is how it's happened before, anyway. Once upon a time, when the Hebrews were scared of a ruthless Pharaoh, God threw up a burning bush and sent Moses not to lament from afar, but to go and take a stand. Once upon a time, in the Promised Land, they got scared again and ran to other gods. So he sent prophets like Elijah and Ezekiel not to shrug from the sidelines, but to go and take a stand. Even once upon a time after exile, wouldn't you know it, the pressure of the political and religious system brought another kind of scary story. So this time, he came down himself in the person of Jesus and set his own feet, even his whole body, in the mud and dust. This is the sort of friendship that Lazarus needs. Meaningful, sincere, bodily friendship that takes a stand. This is how God responds and invites us to respond to the scary story. There will always be those thrown down, thrown out, thrown away. There will always be the ones left to the dogs. There will always be the ones left outside the gate. There will always be the ones left for dead. There will always be the rich man who sees them as nothing and does nothing about it. There will always be those that are encountering scary stories. Eventually, my wife took the scary monster book out of the freezer and, harmlessly enough, put it on the kitchen table. The next morning, when Lily saw it, she was overwhelmed with disgust. "What is that doing there? I'm taking it to the freezer." She took the book and put it back, slamming the door behind her. We don't have that luxury. The scary story is out. It has been plucked from its hiding place, and it is as in front of us as our kitchen tables, our smartphones, our doctor's offices, our mailboxes, our social media, our 24-hour news cycle. We can see the scary story from our pulpit. We can see it from our pews. And yes, we know that those thrown around in this world are carried by angels to the next. And we know that those degraded to a status lower than dogs in this world are raised up to Abraham's bosom in the next. And we know that those that beg for crumbs in this world are the first to feast at the table of God in the next. We know that there will always be an eternal hope for Lazarus. But it is a shame that he has to wait so long. At the end of the children's book, lovable furry old Grover realizes that it was only him all along. "Well, look at that," he says. "This is the end of the book, and the only one here is me. I, lovable, furry old Grover, am the monster at the end of this book. And you were so scared. I told you and told you there was nothing to be afraid of. And so it is with us. There is no monster at the end of this sermon. Only us. Only the church. And while we are not always lovable and furry, may we every day, even this day, be a church of friendship to the ones who are thrown out, thrown down, and thrown around. The kind of friendship that rises to take a stand through the whole story. The kind of friend who can legitimately say at the end, I told you and told you, there was nothing to be afraid of. Amen.
Our speaker today was the Reverend Dr. Nate Phillips, co-pastor of Red Clay Creek Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, Delaware. For a free transcript of his message, A Monster at the End of This Sermon, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Remember, Day 1 depends on the financial gifts of faithful listeners like you. Please consider supporting our ministry with a generous donation. We appreciate it. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week on Day 1, we're delighted to have with us the Reverend Dr. Ginger Gaines Sorelli, Senior Pastor of Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. Her message is entitled, Increase Our Faith. You won't want to miss it. Phillips offers some final reflections on today's sermon with our host, Peter Wallace.
Nate, thank you for a powerful take on this story of Jesus's on the rich man and Lazarus. You help to see that for whatever reason, we might have more in common with poor Lazarus than we thought as we deal with illness and tragedy, poverty, hopelessness. In fact, in several other stories from the Gospels that you highlighted, the main characters were thrown aside, thrown down, thrown away. Would you say more about how we might see ourselves or others in our lives in Lazarus and the others who are suffering in these stories?
Yeah, I was intentionally trying to leave the story open for folks to enter the text in their own way. Mm-hmm. And we can look at this in sort of broad terms, right? We can see systemic throwing of people mm-hmm. in lots of different ways in our society. And I also wanted to leave room for people to see it in an individual way. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to allow people to enter that in whichever way made sense for them on the day they listened to the sermon.
Mm-hmm. And you asked, amidst our scary stories, do we live out the story of the rich man or do we carry the story of the church? If we live out the story of the church, Lazarus wouldn't have to wait for an angel to carry him. He'd have friends who care about him, and that's the church's job. What might that look like if we followers of Jesus took that seriously?
I'm beginning to look at the church more simply than I ever thought I might. Hmm. And beginning to realize more and more that friendship is really at the heart of what we're called to do. Hmm. We're called to make friends with people and then open those friendships up to the movement of God to move, to shape the both of us. So what does that look like? I mean, the sermon pointed out that that looks like standing with folks in the middle of their scary stories, having the courage to stand alongside someone in their pain, to not have to try to fix it for them necessarily, but to be present. And that was the shape of the friendship that I wanted to offer today.
Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of friendship that Lazarus needed, you said, a meaningful, sincere, bodily friendship, and this is how God responds and invites us to respond to the scary story confronting us. Of course, there will always be those thrown down and thrown out and thrown away. It can seem overwhelming to deal with the needs around us. So how can we encourage one another to fulfill this call of God on the church?
I think that we have to be open to the different callings that we have. The word mission is one that's thrown around a lot. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when we talk about mission, we talk about letter writing and check sending. And I'd like us to be thinking about mission more and more in terms of friendship. And that would mean that when we're doing our Sunday school class, when we're teaching that class, we're involved in mission because we're creating new friendships with people. Mm. And through those friendships, God is the missionary agent, shaping us, forming us. Also, that might mean going to the city and serving the poor. That could be what one's calling is. We could go to Africa, or we could do all these things. But at the heart of it, mission is really about creating new friendships with people unlike ourselves. And through those friendships, the vulnerabilities of those friendships, we see God shaping us and creating something new.
Nate, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind this week?
I hope through this sermon, we will keep in mind that a bodily friendship is important, that slacktivism, that is the kind of activism that keeps us at a distance, is less than what we're called to by the gospel. And that to stand with someone when they're going through something very difficult, to be present, to not have to fix it, is, I think, more like what God is hoping for us, hoping for Lazarus and anyone that's confronting a scary story in their lives.
Mm. Nate Phillips, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.